thumbnail, and two Coca-Cola cans. As Ken resets the net, Ron hoses down the fish with seawater. Then the gear again goes over the stern. Tom takes the wheel, and off we go once more. 8:30. In a single motion, each stern man swings his fish pick, a sawed-off broom handle with a nail through one end, into a fish, mentally grades it, and flips it into the appropriate crate. Bottom fish tend toward the primitive and primeval. It's as if the net had scooped up a big dipper of antediluvian broth and poured it over the deck. The old-world cartographers who mapped the unknown Western Ocean and inscribed on their charts, "Here be strange beasts," might have had groundfish in mind. Take the flounder. This fossil imprint of a fish, rarely more than an inch or so thick but often 14 inches long, spends a lifetime lying on its left side. Consequently, the left side becomes a kind of belly. And that's good, because the flounder is so flat, hence the name flatfish, and has no belly worth talking about. When born, the flounder has eyes positioned normally, but soon the left eye migrates to the top so that the right side carries both eyes, and the mouth pivots in order to open and close horizontally, as mouths do. The new bottom side loses its gray pigment of camouflage and turns fish belly white. Even more primordial is the monkfish, also called the goosefish and anglerfish, the latter name deriving from the flexible spine tipped with a fishtail-shaped appendage that the creature dangles in front of its mouth. When a smaller something swims in to eat the bait, the monkfish gulps hugely to swallow whatever is near. The death trap mouth is a cavernous thing, full not so much of spiky teeth as stalagmites and stalactites. But more. Around the top half of the body are strange growths of skin resembling sea plants that give a resting monkfish the look of an old weedy stone. Under the mouth, where the pectoral fins should be, are two little finny clawed hands that it uses to scrape out a depression to hunt from. If you've ever seen Creature from the Black Lagoon, then you have an idea of a monkfish. Ron, a big man, struggles to pick up a 4-foot specimen so I can look in its mouth. They come 6 feet and longer. This one's just middle size. He drops it to the deck, pulls out his knife, cuts away the bony head to leave only the considerably smaller tail that contains a single bone. Nobody would eat a head that can eat you, especially when it's this ugly. Who's going to eat that tail? I ask. The flesh is loose, almost like jelly. Damn, that's revolting. Ever had a franchise fish burger? Did you think you were eating red snapper? Monkfish take on the taste of what you cook with them. The lobster goes overboard, although it will almost certainly be eaten before it reaches the bottom. A trawler cannot legally keep lobsters because dragging is such an efficient means of harvest. Trawlers could clear out the species in a year or two. Biggest lobster ever found came up accidentally in a dragnet. 44 pounds. The flounders, looking like speckled, pointy ping-pong paddles, do not need to be cleaned, even though 2/3 of the fish is waste. But the cod, hake, and haddock, heftier fish, must be gutted to keep them fresh. The transom is wet with slime and blood and entrails. Seabirds rise in a tremendous whirling and milling as they grab guts and the small fry that get shoveled overboard. One bird, flying off with a whole fish that it cannot quite get down, gulps frantically to keep it, until a larger one swoops and yanks out the half-swallowed herring. The last of the catch to get cleaned is a big, vicious-looking thing with rows of fangs rather than teeth. I prod it with my boot. "Want to lose a toe?" Ron shouts. "Don't get nosy with a wolffish. It's dead. It's the only one that might not be dead. They'll bite your ass right here on deck. They'll snap as you cut their goddamn heads off." Who eats wolffish? I don't know. Ask Mrs. Paul. With the catch cleaned and stacked, Ron picks up the Coke cans. One has a return for deposit imprint. The other goes overboard. 5 cents, he says. I never guessed a deposit law would work at 40 fathoms. 9:20. The day is cold enough, there's no need to carry 100 pounds of ice, as the trawler must do in summer. The crew hoses down deck in oilskins. Gulls make one more pass at the floating guts, then disappear. Ron and I climb atop the rocking wheelhouse to lie back in the sun as the Allison E unwinds her course over the swells. Before he falls asleep, Ron sniffs and says, "Amazes me. When you're on shore, you smell the sea. When you're at sea, you smell the land." 11:10. Sternmen don oilskins and again haul in the net. A small catch, maybe 400 pounds. There is little talk as they sort and clean. Ron picks up a 3-foot cod by the tail and shakes a half dozen shrimp from its mouth. That's breakfast. Let's see what Big Mama had for supper. He slips the knife in below the anal fin and slits open the belly. Look, inside lies a whole lobster, as red as if just out of the steam pot. I say, "Can you eat a lobster cooked in a cod's stomach? Take a bite and let me know." 11:30. Ron calls in to Tom for permission to throw overboard the blue fish crate. Tom nods. Over it goes, floating off like a little barge. "What's wrong with that crate?" I ask. "It's blue." "So?" "Never bring things blue aboard," Kent says. "Bad luck. Almost as bad as sticking a knife in the deck or leaving a hatch cover upside down. Or saying P-I-G or eating walnuts on board." "You mean you believe if I say pig, nobody believes it? We just don't do it." 12:10. Tom watches the sonar apprehensively. He says, "We may be in trouble, lads." He throttles back and no one speaks. The moony eyes of the fish goggle blankly through the slots in the baskets. Finally, Tom says, "Get ready to haul in." The crew dresses and hurries astern. The catch is again small because of the abbreviated tow. Ron mutters a single word. "Blue." I ask Tom what happened. "I stared into a canyon, rock piles on both sides. No room to turn around without hanging up the gear. There goes $400. $160 million years ago, according to plate tectonic theory, the Atlantic didn't exist. This water was land. For a dragger, it still is. 1:12. The Allison E trawling a new location. I ask Tom what the future of bottom fishing is for Maine. "Good, bad, so-so, all of that. In 76, the government extended the old 3-mile territorial limit to 200 miles to keep foreigners out. Had to do it. Russians and Germans and Japanese were coming in with armadas of trawlers and factory ships that process and freeze the catch. Once they found a good coordinate, they'd sit on it until they cleaned it out. A factory ship can hold 6 months' catch, so their draggers don't have to return to port to refuel or offload. And they used roller nets so they could drag bottom we couldn't. And they fished with 2-inch mesh nets, whereas we have to use 5 inches to let the little ones escape. The Europeans and Japanese lost all their boats during the war, so their governments subsidized new ones in the 60s. Their fleets are newer and more efficient than our Yankee one. We couldn't compete. But since the 200-mile limit, our catch is way up." "That's the good. What's the bad?" "About the same thing. The government. They watch over everything out here now. That helicopter that passed a while back was observers. We've got quotas imposed by marine biologists, although nobody has an accurate idea how many fish are below. You can't count them like elephants. A year ago, we caught the entire East Coast quota for haddock in 2 days. Some of the regulations are just out of line with reason. This is one of the richest fishing grounds in the world. It's why New England got so prosperous in the early years. It's why they hung a gold codfish in the statehouse in Boston in 17 and when. Is the government your main problem? Government, the sea, weather, rocks, a flounder's brain, dogfish tearing open nets to get your catch? Hell, even the church giving up meatless Fridays. Guinea boats up out of Gloucester? Old boats that go down all the time? Not long ago, one dragged across the courses of 15 of our trawlers and tied everybody up. Tell me that wasn't bedlam." 2:40. Wind strong off the coast. Sea a deep blue-black. As the westerlies grow stronger, Tom waves and shouts, "Heist the gear!" Another tow cut short. What began as a good fishing day has turned sour. The sternman cutting the fish struggled to stay upright on the wet, pitching deck. The return to port at 20 knots over the surge of sea is a harum-scarum carnival ride of bouncing and salt spray and following gulls.
"Find a smoother streak, Captain!" Ron yells. "I'm about to slip with this knife and cut a tallywhacker off!"
With everything hosed down and secured, Ron pulls out a couple of big yellowtails. In quick strokes, he slices behind the gills, down the spine, flips the fish and does the same thing, then with two final quick cuts, frees the fillets. "Put your nose here," he says, and holds up the flounder. "Well, I smell a sweetness."
"Sweetness is right. It's fresh.
Once you eat a real, honest, fresh flounder, you won't like what lubbers call fresh seafood. You'll be like the woman after the French tickler. Never satisfied again." He drops a fillet in a bag. Ken says, "Cook it up in your truck tonight. Eat it tonight, or you'll never know what fresh fish is." 4:20. The Allison E warped to the pier. Tom and I watch the catch come up to a broker's truck. Tom calls down,
"Save a nice haddock for the mother-in-law."
To me, he says, "We had to heist early 3 times, and that cost us about $1,000. Our check for this haul will only be about $800. Anytime you pull less than $1,000, it's costing you money." As we wait for the truck to finish stowing the crates, I ask Tom what's the most unusual thing he's encountered at sea.
"Breath of a whale," he says.
I laugh. "Seriously?"
"That's it. When they sound and blow, it's like the mouth of hell opened."
4:50. Tom moves his trawler to anchorage in the harbor and returns to the pier in the punt. "What will you do now after a day on the high sea?" I ask.
"What anyone else here does. Watch television."
5:10. But for the whelm of tide, the pier is quiet and empty of boats, gulls, trucks, fish, and the men that go down to the sea in ships and come home to watch The Price is Right. I walk to my rig, saute the flounder in butter and pepper, and eat. Ron is right. I've become the woman after the French tickler. 4. The main thing here was concrete. Trying to find blue highways down the northeast seaboard wasn't going to be difficult. It was going to be impossible. Using the theory, which had worked in the south, west, and north, that an expressway relieves a paralleling road from congestion, I tried U.S. 1. A highway so famous, there is a book called U.S. 1, which gives a virtual mile-by-mile description of the route as it was in 1938. From New York to Eastport, Maine, much of one follows the old Boston Post Road, which itself followed Indian trails. Highway statistics. Since 1930, American road and street miles have increased only 18%, while car traffic has grown by 50%, truck by 70%. But most of that increase in roadways has come in suburban streets. Even though there is about 1 road mile per square mile in the contiguous states, highways take up less than 1% of the 3 million square miles in the country. I knew U.S. 1, stretching from the Canadian border to Key West, was capable of putting a man in an institution of one kind or another, at least it once was, but I hoped things had changed. They hadn't. The highway was still a nightmare vision of the 20th century, a 4-lane representing, as Mencken has it, the American lust for the hideous, the delight in ugliness for its own sake. After an hour, I gave up, turned onto Interstate 95, and got swept south toward Boston. More statistics. If you poured all the sand, gravel, and cement in American interstates into a 9-foot-thick, 10-foot-high wall, it would circle the world 50 times. I went down the interstate miles, driving, driving. Each mile took up 25 acres, or the equivalent of 40,000 loaves of bread, so I've heard. Tractor-trailer rigs, using 2/3 more fuel per cargo ton than a locomotive, blasted me all the way to Boston. Then to the west, 50 minutes from Haymarket Square, I found Massachusetts 16, a quiet road out of Wellesley that ran down through stands of maple, birch, and pine, down along brooks, across fens, down miles of stone walls covered with lichens. Many New England stone fences built between 1700 and 1875 were laid by gangs of workers who piled stone at the rate of so much a rod. Edwin Wayteal says that in the latter years of the past century, before economic and social developments began obliterating some of the walls, there were 100,000 miles of stone fences in New England. Even today, for many of them, the only change has been the size of the lichens, those delicate rock-eating algae that can live 900 years. At Holliston, I stopped and took a sandwich and bottle of Moxie, once advertised as the only harmless nerve food known that can recover loss of manhood, imbecility, and helplessness, into the old town burial ground and ate lunch while I walked and read the slanting slate tombstones. There were carved urns, hourglasses, and weeping willows. Among the Moore's vincit omnia sentiments were some well-cut death's heads and angels of redemption. Often it's hard to tell the difference because the death's heads evolved into angels, the angels into cherubs, the cherubs into portraits of the deceased. Near the south end of the cemetery, under a big ash, was Lieutenant Joseph Mellon's stone. The Minuteman died in 1787, the year of the Constitution, at the age of 40. Toward the bottom of the marker was a poem that appears on many colonial gravestones in numerous variations. Mellon's version. Behold and see as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you must be. Prepare for death and follow me. In other times, people came to burial grounds for contemplation. Next to the stone lay a crumpled sheet of rice paper. I opened it. There, in a half-completed wax rubbing of the old matrix on Mellon's stone, was a figure of death or redemption. Make your choice. While the grounds were appropriate for musing, for falling inward, the bright day wasn't. And I had no mind to take my darker self, that dogged soldier of the Indian Wars, seriously. I picked up the rubbing and stuck it to a wall of ghost dancing and got moving. I didn't know where. Our destination, Henry Miller says, is never a place, but rather a new way of looking at things. Down State 115 southeast toward Taunton, I had to keep checking route markers for the northwestbound traffic in order to stay on course. Rule of the Blue Road. The highway side to where you've been is better marked than the one to where you're going. Perhaps inclined by days past, I found myself heading toward Narragansett Bay, an area in which I'd spent my Navy service during the 60s. The whole time, the shining waxen eyes of the old stone face, like Uncle Sam's on the recruiting posters, watched from every angle. 5. Fall River, Massachusetts is chiefly memorable for me as the factory city I've never driven through without losing the way. Once there, predictably, inexplicably, and utterly, I am confounded by the knots of concrete. So, that day, entangled again, it was like old times. Maybe that's what set me up to expect Newport to be the same. The island of Rhode Island is a misshapen boot in Narragansett Bay. Just above the instep stands the old town center of Newport, and around the sole stepping into the Atlantic is the other Newport, that of the exclusive Oceanside Gilded Estate cottages, detached in space, attitude, and history. Old Harborside Newport, however historic, was never quaint. It was much too rough and lusty for that. Nor was it ever a preserved relic like Wickford or picturesquely cute like Little Compton, other Rhode Island villages. In short, it was a real sea town. I'd spent my share of Navy time in Newport down on Thames Street, also known as Bloody Alley, which had ever been the waterfront thoroughfare, although things had slipped and no longer was it the main business street. But in the 17th century, only a madman or seer might have predicted that upstart New York City would have an avenue more important than the alley. Thames Street, a narrow, dark trench of a lane under hip roofs and gables and old doorways with fan lights, had seen the likes of Captain Kidd, Roger Williams, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Lafayette, Rochambeau, Kosciuszko, Baron Steuben, Count von Fersen, a lover of Marie Antoinette, Nathaniel Greene, Gilbert Stuart, Stephen Decatur, Oliver Perry, Battle of Lake Erie, Matthew Perry, opening of Japan, Herman Melville, most of the Vanderbilts, Astors, Rockefellers, and Kennedys, and 1,000,000 fishermen and sailors. Not bad for a street that began as a swamp. Citizens of Newport hanged pirates at the north end of the alley. Buccaneers and merchantmen refitted ships at the Thames Street wharfs, and Englishmen impressed American seamen they found wandering the Strand, as it was once called. The first cobblestones were bought with receipts levied on each slave imported from Africa. Later, any Negro who owned a pig and sty could vote in a mock election for a black governor at the corner of Thames and Farewell Streets. In one house nearby, a boy in his father's arms, upon seeing George Washington, said, "Why, Father, General Washington is a man." To which the general replied, "Yes, only a man." After the British stole the town blind and devastated the area, following their 3-year occupation during the Revolutionary War, new businesses grew up around Thames. Sugar refining, rum distilling, malt brewing, the bottling of sperm whale oil. Sea captains' children, hoping for a pet monkey or a parrot from Brazil, came down to Thames Street to meet their father's ships. Officers of the line walked between piled boxes of Turkish brass, Chinese porcelain, Persian carpets, Japanese lacquerware, Indian spices, and they caroused in clubs where they drank Newport punch made of rum, lime juice, arrack, and loaf sugar. Before the Civil War, summer colonists from Charleston, Mobile, Havana, and the Indies strolled the Strand, although few stayed after dusk. Fishermen pitched pennies and bet on impromptu dogfights and sold fish from wheelbarrows on Bannister's Wharf. Paro Bannister, a long-nosed oysterman, died suddenly and had to be buried in a makeshift coffin so shallow the undertaker was forced to cut a hole in the lid for Paro's nose. When I saw Thames Street the first time in the 60s, it was still a dark little guttery thing filled with the odor of beer and fried food and dime store perfume. The noise was music, shouts, laughter, gull screeches. The Navy remained its main order of business. At 5 o'clock on a summer evening, when the alley really came to, you saw pressed white uniforms of the gobs, shining black Oxfords, and faces wiped down with Old Spice. But as the street emptied in the dark morning, the uniforms now smudged and rumpled and stinking of beer, there would be vomiting and sometimes fights. While the terms differed to sailors and high society, the 400, alike, Thames Street was the asshole of Newport. Only when the cup races brought the regatta to town would the 400 and the gentlemen from the War College come down to the alley to play at the nautical life. Then the attitude was, sailors and dogs keep out. Newport entrepreneurs neglected Thames because they believed that Broadway and the North End highways should have the new commercial growth. And so shopping centers saved the alley from the 20th century. From one war to the next, waterfront changes were small and slow, and the past, seamy and seedy and alive, continued. I came to like the street. It possessed something uncommon. Now, nearly 15 years since I'd last seen it, I walked into the lane where Washington Square, actually more an isosceles triangle, meets the old Long Wharf. The harbor side of the street was gone. Where 17th and 18th century buildings had stood were parking lots and a mall. My expectations sank as if flushed down a scupper. Most of the city side of the street, now called America's Cup Avenue, had been modernized into shops of concrete and glass that sold polymer plastic scrimshaw, driftwood lamps, lighted whelk shells, garish seascapes, marijuana leaf belt buckles. The seamen's taverns had yielded to places with old-style signs, spirits and victuals, grog happy hour. Navy outfitters were now women's shoe shops, tattoo parlors, perfume boutiques. Where jack tars had walked with the sway the sea teaches, now co-eds from the Seven Sisters waggled their precious butts atop Papagallos, and permanent press matrons, safe in tummy-control spandex, their triceps swinging in the wind, lugged purses the size of sea bags. I stopped for a beer. The bartender brought a Narragansett. I asked what had happened to Thames Street. Redevelopment for urban blight. The bar was crowded. America's Cup Avenue was clearly a moneymaker. A man, young, said, "They trashed the place to save it. The American plan." How did it happen? Navy cut back? Businessmen wanted tourists who'll spend more than sailors? But the history. American history is parking lots. The room was full of girls with orchid-colored lips, signed trousers, and disco pumps, hands full of high-technology cigarettes and sugary day-glow drinks. Faces agog with the falal and frippery of the new Thames Street. They jabbered with 21-year-old men of all ages. I was glum and sour and critical of everything. The talk washed over me. One touch-and-glow girl had her arm wrenched behind her, wiggling it about. I thought she was winding herself up, but she was just scratching her back. "Jesus," she said, "I'm buying clothes like they were going out of style." A man with a voice hollow like the drip of water in an empty pan complained, "She's not so pretty. Anyway, vanity's only skin deep." A squatty girl, working hard for that elusive leggy look, said, "He's so trite. Nobody talks like that." I remembered an old fisherman I'd met in a tavern where a parking lot was now. He'd lost a thumb to a kink in a line, but he believed he'd had a good life. Around his neck hung a small scrimshaw, showing a crude yet detailed image of the Holy Virgin, carved from the knuckle of his thumb. "Your own bone," he had said. "She's the best luck." And I remembered another conversation I sat in on across the street. A third-class gunner's mate told a seaman apprentice about peeling off the bandages and swiving a Haitian whore 5 days after his circumcision. He wasn't lying. The day we pulled out of Port-au-Prince, I saw the infection. Somewhere between that vile past and the vacuous present, somewhere between history and trends, there must have been other possibilities for Thames Street that the burghers of Newport missed. There was no point staying on. What I'd come for was gone, replaced by things available all over the United States. The Newport-Jamestown ferry was extinct, too, superseded by a 2-mile bridge. I said to the toll keeper, "Damn expensive bridge. The toll, that is." "We got a joke here. It's high because it's high. Get it? They built it so aircraft carriers at Quonset Point could sail under. As soon as the paint dried, the Navy pulled its bird farms out of Narragansett Bay." "What's the bridge here for, anyway?" "Opens Newport up to New York City traffic. Lot of new businesses to support here now." They might just as well have opened the old harbor town to the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I went on toward Quonset Point, the home port of the ship I had been assigned to. The USS Lake Champlain, a World War II flat top, once held the transatlantic speed record, and it pulled out of the sea America's first spaceman, Alan Shepard. I'd heard the carrier had been sold for scrap, but I wanted to see the ships that had taken her berth, if I could get permission to go on the pier. As things turned out, I didn't need to worry about permission. On the west side of the base, where Seabees invented the Quonset hut, was a carnival. The new Navy, I thought. I drove down the long row to the air station and wondered what excuse might get me in. Ironic, after all the time I'd spent years ago thinking up reasons to get out. But the gates were open, sentry boxes unmanned, the 10-foot chain-link fence torn and leaning. Still, I expected base security any minute. One of the mess halls had a name on it like a restaurant. The new volunteer Navy. At the end of the road, a mile in, the big pier was empty. Nothing but rusting stanchions and bollards and weeds along the railroad tracks. The whole bay stood open and vacant. The Champ, the Essex, the Wasp used to fill the sky with gray masses of hull, gun, and antennas. The great carriers were gone, and also tugs, tenders, big naval cranes, helicopters, jets. The shouts and hubbub and confusion of sailors and machines and aircraft, all gone. On the shore, a man was stacking lobster traps. "Lobster traps? What the hell's happened here?" I shouted over to him, but it didn't carry. I walked out on the pier where a lone tern watched. Once there was a gull for every sailor, lobster traps. I was mad at seeing my service come to this. I had lived and died walking off and on this pier, and many times had dreamed of the day I'd come back as a civilian, free of the tyranny of the bosun's pipe and his curses, free of working in a 125-degree steel box. I felt cheated. Where the hell was the diesel oil of yesteryear? Where the drawn faces when we left, the cock-a-hoop faces when we returned, the sailors kissing girls and lugging sea bags, mahogany statues, brass platters, straw hats, and black velvet paintings of bulls and naked native women, trucks honking, the sailors on duty cursing down from the deck and offering services to the women, the sea wind snapping the flag from the jackstaff, the last smoke blowing grit on us from the tall stacks, and now lobster pots. Christ, I knew you couldn't go home again, but nobody had said anything about not getting back to your old Navy base. A horn blared. A man with a bulgy, bulbous head shouted, "Got official business out here, Mac?" That was more like it. He was a Rhode Island Port Authority watchman, with all the command bearing of a dirty rag, but he was better than nothing. Writing my license number down on his clipboard, he did his best to be properly official. "What's your name, Mac?" That was much more like it. "I was stationed here on the Champ, CVS 39. She was a sub-hunter." "What's your name?" "Drexel." "What's your first name?" "That's it. Drexel. Drexel Twitty. I can't believe it's all gone. Never saw it before the Navy turned it over to us. Okay, sailor, take your look-see and get your butt out of here by dark." He drove off, and that was my triumphal return to Quonset Point Naval Air Station. In the evening, I went down along the Petaquamscut River to find a restaurant on the Sound at Narragansett Pier called the Sunnyside. It was the kind of eatery that people start talking about by saying, "I know a great little place." We used to eat cherry stones on the half shell, clam chowder, Johnny cakes, and sausage, and drink Ballantine ale. After what I'd been seeing, I didn't expect it to be there, and it wasn't. Instead, condominiums and tennis courts. So I had supper at the Green Inn, a huge, green-shingled Victorian-era hotel just down from what was left of the Towers, a last-century casino bridging Ocean Road. I ate Little Necks on the half-shell and drank Ballantine Ale, once the most distinctive American brew, until Falstaff bought the company and modernized the brewing process. Outside the window in the last light, I could see the Atlantic horizon bend into a soft parabola by the old glass. Plastic scrimshaw, carnival rides, condos. That was what history had come to. Then, like a night-blooming Sirius, a thought opened. Maybe the whole point of going to sea was to make room one day for lobster pots and roller coasters. To melt warships into Ferris wheels, that had to be progress. Maybe all I'd been cheated of was a preconceived notion of what the future looks like. After dinner, I parked for the night on a jetty hooking into the Sound and walked up the shingled beach. Breakers tumbled the round stones back and forth, ringing out of them curious metallic measures. For 300 years, warships had sailed the bay. Now dodgem cars replaced gun tubs. But it was all a fiction of progress. There were more warheads now than when I went to sea. Changes, yes, but movement away from the machinery of war, no. On another shingled beach in another century, Matthew Arnold spoke of ignorant armies clashing by night. Present situation report. As they say in Selma, ain't nothing changed. 6. An Englishman once had a good laugh when I asked how far it was to Chichester, a name I hadn't come close to pronouncing properly. I tried 3 other ways and still didn't get it right. He was in stitches.
"Oh, you yags just slay me."
"Okay, pal," I said. "Tell me the body of water Seattle is on. That ought to be easy. It's only 5 letters." I started to spell it.
"I can spell it, mate.
P-U-G-E-T. And I'll pronounce it for you, too.
Puget."
I laughed, and he tried Puget. More laughter made him desperate, so he tried a little French, the last resort of the English.
Puget.
"Nope. It's Puget. You limeys just kill me."
"Look," he said, "all you have to do to pronounce Chichester is soften the vowels and swallow more than you say. The English must do well in Rhode Island, what with all the softening and swallowing necessary to pronounce the descriptive Algonquian place names. Chepawanixet, Anaquatucket, Uskapo, Wenasquatucket, Nanaquaket, Quanicantog, Quanatumpic. If you like the letter Q, you'll love little Rhodey of the big names. Someone once said that if Niagara Falls were in Rhode Island, the English settlers would have pronounced it Nifles. There are other names here, thank heavens, just as distinctive but still pronounceable. Take, for example, the meandering county roads that most states would identify by numbers or letters. Willie Woodhead Road, Widow Sweets Road, Hog House Hill Road, Molasses Hazard Road, Biscuit City Road, Boom Bridge Road, Yagoog Road, Papa Squash Road, or Little Elder Ballin Meeting House Road, a lane you can drive faster than spell. The night before, the sea and sky had been the same color, black, with only liquid spangles of reflected light distinguishing one from the other. When I woke, they were again the same color, but now like melted sapphire. Just off the jetty, a lobster boat rolled and bubbled as the skipper lowered his traps single-handedly. I started down the coast. If down means southward, and you think of the Atlantic seaboard striking a longitudinal line, you'll be disoriented in Rhode Island and Connecticut as you follow the ocean. The coastline runs almost due east and west, hence the name Westerly, Rhode Island, a town just off the Atlantic and west of everything in the state. It was here, so I read, during the Dorr Rebellion in 1842, that General John B. Stedman was charged with maintaining martial law in the town. At one point, when he thought an attack imminent, he told his troops, "Boys, when you see the enemy, fire and then run. And as I am a little lame, I'll run now." When I crossed the Pawcatuck River into Pawcatuck, Connecticut, just up the old post road from Wequetequock, I realized I was heading straight into New York City. I had two choices: drive far inland to bypass it, or take the new London Orient Point ferry to Long Island and cut through the bottom edge of the Apple. I headed toward New London, through Mystic, where they used to build the clipper ships. Indians called New London Namiog. White settlers called it by a tribal name, Pequot, and their descendants renamed it New London, believing as they did that the little village on the Deepwater Harbor would become one day the greatest city of the East Coast. They even changed the Monegan River to the Thames. And so went the Native American names. In New London, the only thing that smacked of old London was the old world street system. Nowhere a true square or rectangular block between Shaw's Cove and Winthrop's Cove. Even Benedict Arnold's 1781 torching of the town didn't help straighten the lanes. A policeman on foot motioned me to the curb for driving the wrong direction on a one-way street. I was only four blocks from the ferry slip, but it took a complex of turns to get through the labyrinth. The ferry, an old oily tub holding a few cars, bucketed down the deep river that had seen Indian canoes, Revolutionary War privateers, whaling ships, Coast Guard rum chasers, and three generations of submarines. At the railing, I tried to watch both sides of the river. The west bank with grassy homes and an old lighthouse, and on the east bank, the Groton shipyards. An engineer for Singer Company, once only makers of sewing machines, but now also manufacturers of undersea warfare systems, stood next to me. His face was a whorl of lines, like fingerprint. I asked where they built the submarines, and he pointed to a dagger of a shadow. "That black thing is the Ohio. She's the first Triton. The orange bull on blocks is the Michigan." How can anything that big move underwater? They're longer than the Washington Monument. The Ohio will carry 24 missiles, each one with a dozen warheads, 288 atomic explosions. One hell of a bitch with 12 sisters coming along behind at $1 billion each. He offered a chiclet. They used to name battleships after states because they were the dreadnoughts of the sea. But there's your dreadnoughts of the next war. What next war? You think war is finished? Whatever peace we'll know will come because of things like those devils. Let me tell you about my uncle, who collected handguns and worked up at Colt in Hartford. He had an 1870 Colt revolver called the Peacemaker, because it was so deadly. Those Tridents are the new peacemakers, but they call them deterrents now. By that logic, the greatest peacemaker would be a doomsday machine. Remember one thing, Kremlin is the Russian word for fortress. If those uncivilized maniacs in the fortress ever come to their senses, then maybe we can make some changes. It's not real fashionable now to believe in military power, but it will be again, and when that happens, people will love those exploding cigars. I've seen both sides. I was in the hooligan navy. What's the hooligan navy? Where hooligans did the dirty work. I was on Red Beach in 44. I can still hear the blue whispers coming at us. A little streak of blue smoke and a hiss and you were gone. I was so scared I wished I was dead. All the time we had been talking, a father on the other side of me entertained his baby with the blink of his LED watch. The baby in a knitted cap that said Polly burbled at the red numbers and reached a clumsy half-fist toward it. Polly didn't know, but across the way, the General Dynamics Electric Boat Company was putting his world together for him. I said to the engineer, "Isn't this ferry some kind of old Navy craft? An LSM they brought out of the Pacific after the war and put a new superstructure on. She's been making this crossing since 1948, but she's in her last month. They got a new, specially designed boat just about ready." When John Steinbeck began his 1960 tour of the United States that he describes in Travels with Charlie, he crossed Long Island Sound on this very boat and worried about the nuclear submarines of an earlier day. Yet a couple of decades later, that great flash of light still had not shown mankind the way out. Watching the shipyards disappear from view, the engineer said, "Maybe it's a crazy way to be sane, but men are most reasonable when they're scared." Ever seen a cornered animal? We're not animals. We crossed the east end of the sound, over a strip of water known as the Race, and passed close by a small, brushy island topped with a smokestack. "Talk of animals," he said. "There's what worries me. Plum Island. The Dangerous Animal Disease Laboratory. What do they consider a dangerous animal? It's diseases that are dangerous, not animals. But I couldn't say for sure what they study there. Glanders, tularemia, plague. I'm not certain. I don't even know if the Pentagon has a role in the research. But give me an atomic warhead any day to disease warfare. The time's coming, though, when we'll fight with germs. Economics will force it, because it's more efficient to kill with bugs than steel. Compared to a drum of cholera, a trident's a thing of beauty. Myself, I've always preferred an earache to a toothache." 7. If you want to hear distortions and misconceptions laced with plenty of dogmatic opinion, you have a choice of three places, excluding domed governmental edifices and buildings with steeples: bars, sports arenas, and gas stations. Barbershops have lost position because of electronics. You can't hear over the hair dryers. As filling stations cease to be garages and community centers, as they become nothing but expensive nozzles, they too are losing ground. But in the past, an American traveler depended on the local grease pit boys to tell him, A, the best route to wherever, B, the best place to eat, although librarians give better recommendations, and C, what the townsfolk thought about whatsoever. Now, it already may be too late for a doctoral candidate to study the ways that Americans' views of each other have been shaped while waiting for the tank to fill. Orient Point, Long Island, was a few houses and a collapsed four-story inn built in 1810. So I went to Greenport for gas. At an old-style station, the owner himself came out and pumped the no-lead and actually wiped the windshield. I happened to refer to him as a New Yorker. "Don't call me a New Yorker. This is Long Island." I meant the state, not the city. "Manhattan's 100 miles from here. We're closer to Boston than the city. Long Island hangs under Connecticut. Look at the houses here, the old ones. They're New England style because the people that built them came from Connecticut. Towns out here look like Connecticut. I don't give a damn if the city's turned half the island into a suburb, we should rightfully be Connecticut Yankees. Or we should be the 7th New England state. This island's bigger than Rhode Island any way you measure it. The whole business gets my dander up. We used to berth part of the New England whaling fleet here, and that was a pure Yankee business. They called this part of the island the Flukes, because Long Island even looks like a whale. But you go down to the wharf now, and you'll see city boats, and a big windjammer that sells rides to people from Mamaroneck and Scarsdale. He got himself so exercised he overfilled the tank. But he didn't pipe down. If the East River had have been 10 miles wide, we'd have been all right. He jerked the nozzle out and clanked it into the pump. We needed a bay, and we got a bastard river no wider than a stream of piss. Thus chastised, I went down a pleasant little road numbered 25, down the North Fluke, through neat vegetable truck farms with their typical story-and-a-half houses, past estuaries and swans, to Riverhead. I followed a pickup with 4 bloodied sharks laid out in the bed. It looked like a tin of evil sardines packed in ketchup. The side road ended, and I got pulled onto an expressway as if I were part of a train. I buckled the seatbelt, popped in a piece of bubble gum, put on my 12 o'clock high sunglasses, and got ready for the city. You'd have thought I was going to run the Gaza Strip, but it was Islip, Babylon, Amityville, Merrick, Oceanside. The belt roadway showed the backsides of suburbs and miles of carpet sample, unclaimed freight, factory outlet, and furniture warehouse stores. Half of them gone under, the others with windows blocked by giant prices. Things raced past, like the jumpy images of a Nickelodeon. Abandoned and stripped cars on the shoulders, 2 hitchhiking females that nobody could stop to pick up, a billboard, eat sausage and be happy, low-flying jumbos into Kennedy International, the racetrack at Ozone Park, bulldozed piles of dirt to fill the marsh at Jamaica Bay, long and straight Flatbush Avenue, Sheepshead Bay, Coney Island, the World Trade Center, like stumps in the yellow velvet sky. Then a windingly protracted ascent up the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, the Silver Gate of the East Coast, with its world's longest center span. And below, the bay, where the Great Eastern, the Monitor, the Bonhomme Richard, and the Half Moon sailed. The low sun turned the upper bay orange. Freighters rode at anchor or headed to the Atlantic, and to the north in the distance, a little glint of coppery green that was the Statue of Liberty. I slowed to gawk and got a horn. The driver passed in a gaseous cloud and held aloft a middle-digit opinion. The lanes descended and shot me across Staten Island. Just before it was too late, I pulled out of the oppression of traffic and drove down Richmond Avenue to find the bridge across the Arthur Kill into Perth Amboy, the city, if you follow your nose, that gets to you before you get to it. I don't know how I lost my way on a thoroughfare as big as Richmond, but I did. I could smell Perth Amboy, but I couldn't find it. Instead, I found Great Kills, Eltingville, Huguenot Park, Princess Bay, and Tottenville. I asked directions from a nervous teenager who was either tuning his engine or stealing someone's distributor. Just as darkness was complete, I reached New Jersey and decided to take U.S. 9 to get through the congestion and into the Pine Barrens, the last great natural interruption in the Boston to Washington megalopolis. John McPhee's book on the pines had convinced me that anyone wanting to see it should do so immediately, what with subdividing realtors, industrial parks, reservoirs, and supersonic jetports. 40 minutes later, I was already in Lakewood, midway down the state. I stopped for the night, still surprised I'd begun the day in Rhode Island. I had forgotten to think in the compressed distances of the Northeast. 8. It isn't widely known in America that the descendants of Jolly Roger pirates put an end to dirigible flight. So I heard at breakfast in a diner. Actually, it was a full restaurant, but it had started as a diner. It was done up in red drapes and coachman lanterns, and at the door a concrete cupid stood in a dry fountain surrounded by a polymer privet hedge. The eggs had been fried in Vitalis, and the potatoes carried a crisp, woody flavor. I felt fine anyway.
The waitress, with a grudge of a face and a golden chain cutting into a puffy ankle, complained her way around. Everyone seemed to like her, although she had no good tidings for anybody. "You get enough sleep last night?" she asked me. "I don't know. I drove after dark. Almost missed New Jersey."
"Miss Jersey? So what's the miss?"
"New Jersey's to miss. Nobody comes to Jersey to see Jersey."
"I did.
I'm going into the middle of New Jersey to see it."
"Middle? What's this middle? You got the shore, and you got Philly."
"Middle? There is no middle. Fort Dix is the middle."
"The Pine Barrens. 20 kinds of orchids growing in there, they say. Bug-eating plants, too."
She rolled her eyes.
"You're on the dirty side now. Ask any trucker. You want orchids, go to a florist."
A man next to me wore a shirt that repeatedly said, "Oro." Around and around, the words looped his paunch, his droop of shoulders, his yellowed armpits. Among the oros were golden things, coins, watches, medallions, coronets.
"Let me tell you about the pines," he said. "Maybe you heard of the Hindenburg, the Zeppelin? But I'll let you in on the true story of what really happened. I've lived here all my life, and I know what happened even if the government said they didn't know."
The gist was this. A storm forced the Hindenburg into a holding pattern. That was a fact I could check out. The airship, only a few hundred feet off the ground, circled central New Jersey for 2 hours. Lakehurst, where it was trying to land, is on the edge of the pines, and everyone knows pineys don't tolerate anyone poking into their woods. They figured the Zeppelin was a government ship looking for their stills, where they turn blueberries into whiskey. So they shot at the thing and opened leaks in the fabric. By the time the Hindenburg started to tie up, there was enough free hydrogen to blow the ship to kingdom come, which it did. "The official explanation was St. Elmo's fire," he said. "Static electricity. St. Elmo never in his life set fire to any aircraft. People can believe it was anti-Nazi sabotage if they want, but I'm telling the truth. It was pot shots by the pineys, and it was nothing new. They're descendants of pirates and smugglers who ran into the woods to hide, mixed in with a few Tories and Hessians." When I paid the waitress, she filled with motherly counsel. "Look, you're a nice boy. Go to the shore. Go to Atlantic City. But for God's sakes, don't go to no middle. The pineys breed like flies in there, live like animals." I'd heard those words across the country. It was almost an axiom that anyone who lived off a main highway was an animal that bred like a fly. An hour later, the June heat coming on, I was on New Jersey 70, heading for the middle. I stopped at Lakehurst Naval Air Station to look at the dirigible hangars, those 1,000-foot-long, 20-story buildings, where the pineys allegedly did in the blimp. Another era of flight ended here, too. Lakehurst was the last place the Navy trained carrier pigeons. The road became a succession of gentle dips through the sandy woods. My head bounced as if my neck were a loose coil of wire. Miles of bouncy-bouncy. I was having fun in the middle. County Road 563 cut through the center of the 650,000 acres, equal to Grand Canyon National Park, of pine barrens. There were pitch pines and oaks and white cedars. Although the trees tended toward the spindly, the land was by no means barren in the sense of unproductive. Cranberry bogs and fields of high-bush blueberries opened the woods in places. The sky was cloudless, not in the usual way, but rather bleached by glare to the color a pair of facing mirrors make between them. Neither blue nor gray, but rather an absence of color. Trees, shrubs, the day, all drooped dead still in the humid heat. And wherever the pineys were, they weren't on the road. Somewhere south of Jenkins, population 45, five was more believable, I gave in to the heat and pulled up under the trees by a small bridge. A stream about half the width of the highway moved through with a good current. I took it to be the Wading River. Bog iron, cannonballs fired at Valley Forge were made here, and tannins had turned the transparent water the color of cherry cola. This cedar water, as it is called, sea captains once carried on long voyages because it remained sweet longer than other waters. Even today, it is remarkably free of pollutants, since all streams that flow through the pines have their source here. I walked up a track into the woods, dead ferns and pine needles absorbing my steps. A silence, as if civilization had disappeared. While the quiet was real, the isolation was an illusion. Downtown Philadelphia lay 40 miles west. What's more, McPhee says that on a clear evening, you can see a light in the pines from the Empire State Building. I came to the stream again, took off my clothes, and went in. There was no shock in the water, only cooling relief. I let the current pull me downstream toward the Atlantic. Then I paddled back up and floated off again. A black terrapin, trimmed in red, surfaced, saw me float by, blinked, and went under. I climbed out and let the heat dry me as I ate. McPhee reports that in the 20s, a Philadelphia newspaper gave away lots in the pines as premiums with new subscriptions, and that during the Depression, movie houses passed out deeds to small tracts as door prizes, and that realty agents offered lots here for $5. McPhee writes, "When prospective buyers actually came to see the land, promoters tied pears and apples to the limbs of pine trees and stationed fishermen in small boats in Pine Barrens lakes with dead pickerel on the ends of their lines and instructions to pull the fish out of the water every 10 minutes. But no one cared for the giveaways, and even now, although the margins of the pines were shrinking from commercial encroachments, the heart of Burlington County, the middle of the pine lands, still belonged to the quiet and pineys. Whenever that last foot of concrete is poured to complete the Boston-Washington megalopolis, it's likely to be in the Pine Barrens." I went on south, through Weekstown, past a wooden sign nailed clumsily to a tree. Always in our memories, Pete. I came to the southern limits of the woods at Egg Harbor City, a landlocked town 15 miles from Great Egg Harbor. The plan years ago to dig a canal from town to the Great Egg Harbor River and thereby link with the sea did not work out. It wasn't the first time so-called progress had got lost in the pines. 9. In the afternoon, when I was down along Delaware Bay and trying to find how Othello, New Jersey got its name, I came across a story of the past, the future, the present. As the Pine Belt disappeared, the state took on a southern cast below Millville, an old glassmaking town on the Maurice River, flowing through the exposed silica deposits of Lower Jersey. Near here, the first mason jar was made. Outside Bridgeton, the southern aspect showed plain. Big fields of soybeans, corn, cabbage, strawberries, and fallow fields of dusty brown, and slopes of peach and apple orchards. Black men worked patch farms, and with cane poles they fished muddy creeks of the lowlands, where egrets stepped meticulously through the tidal marsh. I drove up and down. The map wasn't getting me to Othello, and neither were the county roads. I came to Greenwich, population 1,000, a village built along a broad single lane called Ye Great Street, Y-E correctly pronounced as The, which ran from a rotting boat landing on the Cohansey River northwest for 2 miles, most of the way lined with old homes and buildings. In the 17th century, Great Street meant Main Street, but now Great, in the sense of grand, was also accurate. Of the nearly 100 homes and buildings along the three-century-old thoroughfare, about 90% were built before 1880, and more than a quarter dated from the 18th century. Even the Sunoco station was in a 1760 house. Although the old structures appeared sound, only a few had been restored. Greenwich was a Williamsburg with a difference. It wasn't dug out of the ground and rebuilt. There was another difference, too. It didn't have that unnaturally genteel, sanitized look of the Virginia village that turns it into a museum. Surely the first Williamsburg must have been a knockabout frontier town, a place of skullduggery and war, where the laundry got hung out and dogs pissed in the muddy lanes, where the scent of dung and wet horses was strong. To resurrect that town and play-act the past is a good thing for Williamsburg, but it wasn't the way of Greenwich. hidden in the tall marsh grass of the coastal lowland, the whilom seaport that once rivaled Philadelphia was remarkable. I stopped at Arnold's grocery, post office, and filling station, two pumps under a southern-style canopy. Here the